Last few years, we've been miyached to speak about someone who, from our tkufa, our zelavonin, our adira teira, that we've lost and so on. Last year, we spoke about someone who lived through it and was a udmut zlameish. And this year, we'll also speak about somebody who was, in many ways, the our zelavonin, the ud that lived through it from beginning to the end. The person is the Kloizenberger Rebbe. My father's Zechon Evracha was together with him in the DP camps and would tell me about him. My father occasionally took me to Tisch when I was a very young boy. We would walk over the bridge and I would see it as a young boy. It left an impression. As an older person, I heard him. I once went to hear him speak. He was mostly Tanya, but he was on Yerushalayim, so I went to Yerushalayim to speak. And so I have a glimpse of the person, but nothing. But I want to talk a little bit about the extraordinary demus. To talk about Kozmi Rebbe, we need to go back a few dairis, because in certain ways, he was an embodiment of a certain mahalach. The founder of the Sanza Shoshelis, of the Sanza dynasty, was the Divrei Chaim. Divrei Chaim was born in 1790s, and he passed away around 1880. He was a Talmud Chochem Otzum. He was a Goyen Adir, Divrei Chaim. He was one of those Gedolei Chassidus that was recognized by the whole world as being a Goyen, and b'meila it allowed Hasidus to become accepted because there was no Oirim on him mitzad as being a Talmud Chacham and mitzad his Kedusha and Tahara. People were noyig only with the specific Yonah Hasidus, there were Tainis, but the Divrei Chaim was someone, Reb Chaim Sanza was someone who was above reproach in any way. He was a Goyen Muflog. He wrote, we have tshuvas of his, Divrei Chaim, that are classic tshuvas, tremendous chrifas, yedias. He was a tremendous zohir in mitzvahs, in a kitzonistic way, tremendous medaktik in mitzvahs, tremendous ascetic. Oyver Hashem, davening with a tremendous hislavus, extraordinary, and very, very extreme in terms of chesed and tzedakah. They said that he never left a prut in his house overnight, that he was mechalak everything to aniyim. He was an extraordinarily extreme person every shetach of Torah, whether it's Talmud Chacham, whether it's tefillah, whether it's chesed, dikduka mitzvahs, yiras Hashem. One of the inyanim that he fought for was there was a certain chesidus that was becoming going into Mahalach that seemed to him very comfortable and a little bit too indulgent, and he was leichem strongly against it. It was a very, very, it was a big tohar and Yirei Hashem. That was Reb Chaim Sanza. His great-grandson was a Kloizenberger Rebbe, Ben Achaben. He was born in 1905 in a town in Galicia called Rudnik. And he was he was a brilliant, brilliant child. And in many ways, what we know of him and what we saw of him sounds like the stories about his great grandfather. He was a Goyen Otzum. He would say as Tishn, Friday night, the first stickle was Torah. You could say two and a half hours a pilpul on a ktzais. He knew no time, and he had a tremendous, his pashas and learning was extraordinary. He was a Ilui, was a very special child, and his father was his Rebbe. At the age of 14, he lost his father. He said a hesped on his father that astounded the Kehillah. And at the age of 15, he went around to Gedolei Yisrael to get smicha, to do shimush. And Ad Echad, they were all extremely nispoil from him. I mean, they write about him extraordinary things. He was a prodigy. At the age of 15 or so, one of the Gedolei Rabbanim, the Atze Chaim from Sighet in Hungary, took him as a son-in-law, and he eventually became Rav in Cloisenberg, which was in Transylvania, was the capital of Transylvania, which sort of valgered between different countries, but to us it's Hungary as far as we're concerned. He had 11 children and a rabbanis, and he was becoming famous. This was at the age of 35 when the war broke out. So at 35 he was chashev rav. Cloisenberg was an established city. It was a bigger city rather than a town. It was something where he was known as a goyin olam. Other cities wanted him to come in also, and to Rudnik had asked him. He would go occasionally to Rudnik back and fair tish there. And he was married to one of the Dola Adar's daughters, and 11 extraordinary children. He once said that they had very special neshamas. And then the war broke out in 1940, the war broke out. They went to Hungary. They were Rudnik at the time. They got to Hungary. In Hungary, the Nazis didn't actually come in till 44. And there were a few years of difficult. The Hungarians themselves, they split up. There was a pact. They split up Transylvania, and they went to Hungary. And the Hungary had nationalists that were real anti-Semites, but it was still within the range of the bearable of the normal anti-Semitism, let's call it. In 1944, the Germans broke through, captured Hungary, and even though the Germans already smelled that they were defeated, the Russians had broken through already, and I think Ukraine had already been passed back to Russia, the Russia taken, and so on. The Nazis had one thing on their mind, and that was to be Oike Shem Yisrael. And they came into Hungary and they began the process. The Rebbe lost his wife and 11 children. Arechot. He once said in later years, he said over, it says by Yaakov, Vayikach Vayavirim es Anachal. He said, Yaakov took his wife and 11 children and passed them over the Nachal. He said, I also did, but it was a Nachal of blood, not water. And he lost it, everyone. He was imprisoned in a labor camp in Hungary for a few weeks, and then was sent off to Auschwitz. He was there a few months, and then there was the Germans decided that they need a battalion of workers to clear out the Warsaw Ghetto. Warsaw Ghetto had been totally destroyed, and they thought maybe they'd find valuables, and I don't know, whatever reason they had to clear it. He was sent off with a whole group of people from Auschwitz selected to go there. They worked a few weeks, and then you have to understand what it means to work a few weeks. They would clear buildings that were half bombed without many tools, and if a building collapsed on them, it collapsed on them. So be it. That was the work. At some point, the Germans realized it's not good. They need to get rid of the Jews. They took them to a place, told them to get undressed. There were ditches there, and they were standing with the machine guns, and people were saying Vidui. And a car drove by. The German commander of Warsaw, of Poland, jumped out and he said, "We need these workers immediately in Dachau. In Dachau, they're building things for the army. We need every single one of them." So he took them, brought them to Dachau. The bringing to Dachau was probably the worst and hardest and most difficult part of it. The Germans made them walk or run 120 kilometers first to get to a train. You're talking about people that hadn't eaten, that people hadn't drunk, people that were emaciated skeletons. The Germans drove in cars and whipped them if anybody fell. They went for 4 days, 35 kilometers a day approximately. They gave them bread, salted cheese, and nothing to drink. And this was a sport by the Germans to thirst them to death. It was something which is unfathomable. I mean, they wanted it. They didn't want the workers, but they went and they marched, and people were ready to do anything to drink. And then it was a game. It was a deliberate game. And if anybody stopped by the side to drink something, they would get whipped, clubbed, or killed. They walked like that for 4 days in a hot sun. One of those days was Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av, almost 70 years ago. The Rebbe on Tisha B'Av didn't wear shoes, and he walked barefoot. And the German soldier noticed it, and he pointed that he should walk on the side where they have the little rocks on the shoulder of the road, rocks and glass, that's where he should go. He walked, ran there. He tried to slip out. The soldier saw it and shot him. And he fell with a bullet hole in his side. He realized that if he stays there, he's going to die. And therefore, he grabbed some leaves, wet leaves, stuffed it on the wound, and slipped back in the march. The last day, there was a nice scuttle, and this many people wrote about, even Freie people who were there. It's written up. At night, they had them go to sleep in a dark field. And while they were on the road, people tried to sip all sorts of stuff that was coming on the side, and the Rebbe would tell them, don't. It's poison, don't. They finally came and they collapsed, and the Rebbe whispered that people should start digging. And everybody, whatever they had, they used to dig. And at some point, water began spouting from the ground. And they had lots of water to drink. And it was only in the morning that the Germans saw that they actually had water. To give an understanding of how deep rock could be, one of the sports of the Germans was they had them on this long march. They called for rest, and they had them rest next to a river, and if anybody dared drink from the river, they would shoot him, because they said it was too dangerous to go there. They might drown. It's hard to fathom how deep rishis can be. The tahoim rabba of rishis is unimaginable, but that's what it was. After 4 days of this, where many of the people died, I think a third of a fourth maybe survived this march. They were herded into trains, and for 4 days they were stuffed. They could only stand, and that's it. There's nothing else to do but stand. Their needs was in place. They couldn't get any water, so it rained once or twice, so the water that dripped in from the top, they couldn't sit, nothing. Crushed together, 4 days. And finally, when they got to Dachau, big part of the train was dead. And then they went to work in Dachau. schlepping bricks and concrete and stuff like that. The description of the Rebbe in that kufa, from many people, and not from people either, the Rebbe lived in his own world. The Rebbe never ate anything that wasn't kosher, that was a chashash, that wasn't kosher. The Rebbe managed never to be mechal Shabbos. The Rebbe managed he would have his minhagim is something he would daven under his breath. He went around one Friday, I forgot which camp it was. It was maybe the first camp. And one Friday he went around to people and said, Rachmanim de Rachmanim. He said, In Sanz there was a halig minhag to eat onion on Shabbos. Could somebody spare me a small bit of onion? That was he had a minhag to say Torah Shal Shudas no matter what. Miyoyim that he started as Rabbanis, and he would sit and say Torah to himself. And nobody listening, he would say. It was extraordinary. It was something that really was not to be understood, the koichas ha-nefesh that was needed for it. He counseled other people to eat. He told them they have to eat. He felt that he was different. And he never, ever, he never was mechal Shabbos, never ate tarfis, did everything possible that could possibly be done. He had tefillin for a long time, and there are different kufas was taken away. He managed to find others. Very incredible story of what he of him able to keep himself. And when they were liberated, when the Americans liberated them, the first thing he told the soldiers said, "You're free," the Americans said, "and you know, you're free to go, and you know, very soon we're going to bring you food and stuff." He turned to the soldier and said, "There are Jewish people here, and they need special food, and it's called kosher food. Please get us kosher food." Right outside the camp, this was in Dachau, there was a brook with water that was there teasing people. The amount that they could drink, they would get a little sludge once or twice a day, so-called coffee, to drink. And they would sit and look at this, and people's eyes would pop out waiting to be able to drink. And the Rebbe, as soon as they were free and they could go out, he ran to the river and was tovel himself. And he said, "I was so scared I would die without being tovel myself." And then he asked for a cup and he made a shahakol. And many years later he would say, "The only time I made a bracha like a yid was that shahakol on that glass of water. And I thought it would last with me, and it didn't last with me." You have to understand, the people that were freed were not people. They were pieces of bone attached with pieces of flesh. There wasn't anything there. This was and in spirit, in heart, in everything, these people were gone. And the first thing the Rebbe did after he asked the soldiers, he drained them a cup to get food that was kosher, at least not a problem. Then that Friday night, he organized a minyan. And he needed a talus. People didn't have a yarmulke. He wasn't, a soldier gave him something to drink, water to drink, and he saw what's drinking, he says, "What's the matter?" And he points to his head that he needs a yarmulke, he needs a piece of cloth to put on his head. They managed to get a piece of cloth someplace, and he found wool, and he sat most of Friday unthreading the wool and putting in tzitzis. He ended up with the rice naked tzitzis. He could only do one kesher. It was so tedious, the whole thing. I mean, doing by hand, taking wool and making tzitzis out of hand is difficult. And he ended up, and he davened for the Amid. And he said, "Hoidu, Yoimra Gula Yisrael, Gula Hashem, Ashagolom Yatzar." An hour and a half of Hoidu where people were able to release some of the tsar. There was a tremendous, it was a Kabbalah Shabbos that was incredible. There was the Rebbe Shle, nobody had the spirit, the mind, the heart, and the neshama. People were dead. There wasn't anything there alive anymore. And the Rebbe was the spark that sparked it. He private tish. They found some potatoes, and that was his tish. There was one extraordinary shinui, one eerie change that he made that never explained himself, but it's sort of, you can sort of stab a guess at it. It was a change in Nusach that the Divrei Chaim made the last Friday that he was alive, the last Friday night that he was alive. In the Ribbono Lamim that the Chassidim say between Shalom Aleichem, Shiz Chayil, there's a long Nusach, and Nusach Sfadid, and Chassidim say it. And it says over there that I was Hitzatis mitoisai vidlaktis neroisai. I made my beds, and so Remez, the union of Mita, Friday night, and I lit my candles. The last Friday night of the Divrei Chaim's life, he said, Hidlakti et mitosi, I sent up my beds in flame, vitzatis neroisai, and I've offered up my candles. Rebbe never explained what he meant, but it's fairly easy to feel that I sent up in smoke everything I possess in this world, and all I can offer you is Neiris, Neshama of 11 children, a wife. He once made a Rishima for the American government when he had to meet somebody of 1,000 cousins that he knew by name, 1,000 family members that no longer were there. Mother, uncles, aunts. It was a big mishpacha. It was a chash mishpacha. And Kemat, he was Kemat, the only survivor of that. And he said, HaKadosh Baruch Hu granted me my life only to do something. And from the first second, he was cajoling people, convincing people to begin to come back to Yiddishkeit. And my father was together with him. My father was in Dachau also, and ended up in the same DP camp. My father's from Lithuania, but the Bosan Cheir of Bilbo Salam. And he was actually close. The Rebbe would pass in all the Aguna Shailas without Sfarim. He would write the Truvas Baal Peh. He was incredible. He feared Tish. He was Toivea people to keep doing and to keep and to be choizel to machzavtam, whether it was people who were strange for Yiddishkeit or Hamish Yidden who had dropped it. He was one of those who really, he was the moving force behind it. He organized shchita, he kashrus, mikveh, kisurosh for women, learning with kids, a yeshiva, a cheder. And you're talking about conditions where you had nothing. You're talking about, this was after being freed, but it was something that was not, it was something that wasn't, it wasn't, I mean, people were physically not functioning. People were emotionally and mentally not there. The U.S. government was nice, they bought food stuff, but that was it. And the Rebbe was like from a different world, rekindling. It was like an Eish Tamid Tukad, rebuilding, rekindling, reawakening, and so on. On the first Yom Kippur, if you'll find it written up, Lieutenant Birnbaum, Mayor Birnbaum, who just passed away, he was an army chaplain. He remembered the first Yom Kippur night, the Rebbe davened, Kol Nidre, and the Rebbe spoke. And the Rebbe said, he went through the Vidui, and he said, Ashamnu, Bagadnu, the Vidui wasn't written for us. We had nothing we could do, and there was nothing, you know, we had no ability to do mitzvahs, and no ability to refrain from Averis, and so on. And then he said, when he finished, he said, so what is our vidui? He said, our vidui is that none of us here believed that we would be here. We lost faith in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And he said, and that's a terrible avera that we need to be tshuva for. That when we were marching in that long march, when we were down to 60, 70 pounds, when everything was gone, that we gave up hope, that we didn't understand and didn't believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu would bring us here, that's what we have to do tshuva for. And if there was one inyan that he pushed, and that was in with other people, for himself he had his anhagas, there were strange anhagas, otherworldly anhagas of tzidkis that just, it's we can look at it, we can gaze at it, but it's not something we have shaykhas to. But if we have things that we have shaykhas to, it's going to be his ability. He would go to people, and he was always ma'oided, and always telling him, have a munah, it's going to happen, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will take us out of here, and so on and so forth. That was something that he kept on. That emunah was what he gave to others. He would quote often a Rabbeinu Bechaya, which he embodied, and it's a Rabbeinu Bechaya that if we wouldn't know him, we would never believe it to be true. He would say, there's a Chavis Lavavis says, Elokai, hiraftani. Chavis Lavavis quotes one of Chassidim Rishayim, that he was in a terrible distress, and he said, Elokai, hiraftani ve'erum azaftani. You've hungered me, and you've left me naked. Uvmachshakim v'shaftani, and you've tossed me into darkness. Be'uzcho be'godcho nishpati, I swear by your strength and by your powers. Gamim tisrefeni ba'esh, even if you burn me in fire, lo oisiv kim ava oischa v'simcha becha. All I'll add is more simcha, more ava. And he would say very often himself, he would say, Ribbono Shalom, I came out of the war with nothing. I left my wife, my children, my kehillah, my kravim, my rabbonis, everything is gone. But you, I never left behind. When he remarried a second time to a very shakshuva ungvar, he said under the chuppah, the reason why I was zeicha to what to come back again and to rebuild again is because I never ever lost my emunah in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And I never lost my ava for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And I held on the entire way. There was a friar person in the camps that was at some particularly difficult moment, asked him, Nu Rebbe, Ata V'chartanu? Are you still with Ata V'chartanu? Are you still saying with Kavana? So the Rebbe said, with a lot more Kavana than I ever said it. He said, take a look at them and take a look at us. Tell me the truth. Would you rather be there? Would you rather be a Nazi or a victim? He said, Ata V'chartanu, he says, takes on a whole new meaning to me when I see it. When the Rebbe came back, when the Rebbe came to America first, and then he settled mostly in Eretz Yisrael, he built up Kiryat Sanz. Two of the things that he accomplished, he rebuilt many families who were not Kloisenbergers, who were not Sanze, not Chassidish, but Erlich Yidden. He did a lot of chesed. He rebuilt a community. He built a community in Williamsburg first, in Union City, and Eretz Yisrael. But there were two things that he undertook that were really, really had nothing with Sanz, nothing with Kloisenberg. And both of them took up his energy and his time and his fundraising capacity, and he had nothing for it. One was the Mifal HaShas. He was very upset with the fact that there are no Tamir Chomter, that know Shas, that know it well. And just to learn it with in the Nusach that he had grown up with, where you learn a lot, Nechazer a lot, know a lot. And he created an organization, Mifla Shas, which was not Kloisenberg. It was an independent organization, and they had a set pace to learn, and it's still around, and you get Bechinas once a month and get paid something for it. So like, it was a forerunner of what the issue is, a little bit different. And the people that took the Bechinas were all sorts of young light, people with kippot sugot, people with hats, people with trimals. They all took it. It was not dedicated to any one chelik of Klal Yisrael. It was for everyone. And it's a phenomenal amount of money. It was open for anyone. And the second thing was Laniato Hospital. He built a hospital in Netanya. Again, it's not Kloisenberg Hospital. It doesn't offer any special service to Kloisenberg. It's just a hospital. And they asked him once why. He said when he was laying in the ditch with a bullet hole in his side and a few wet leaves to cover it with, he made a neder that if he gets out of there, nobody hurt, no human being hurt, is not going to have a place to come to for help. And that's why this was a realization of how important refuah is, and he made it. When he made the hospital, he went. There was a lot of opposition from the government. The government, first of all, felt it was overkill. They had a plan for two or three other hospitals in Tanya, which never ever were built. And they also didn't like the fact, whatever it is, the person who was running it was a mapamnik, and he didn't particularly think that a rebbe should be running a hospital. A rebbe should run a shtibel and a minyan, and that's it. And he told the Kloisenberg rebbe, listen, rebbe, you have religious interests, so I'll tell you what. I will build the hospitals, we'll staff it, you give the hechsher on it. You'll give the hechsher on the food, and you'll give the hechsher after something medical, whatever it is, we'll let you be the rav. And he told him, just like a rav teaches Torah, he teaches chesed. It's for too long the kilkel has been that everything, that rabbonim are just there for hashgacha. Rabbonim are there as a fount of chesed. And that's what I'm doing. The effort and the energy that went in to raise money for these hospitals. And they told him, somebody came to him and said, maybe we should put, like in every room, like nice little booklets explaining about Yiddishkeit, how wonderful it is, how good it is. And the Rebbe said, no, that's what missionaries do. He says, when a person will walk into a hospital and be greeted by a doctor and a nurse the way a Yid is supposed to greet a Yid who's sick, and he's given the care and the attention that the Torah wants to give us, that will be the biggest message about Torah. I don't need a booklet. If you need a booklet explaining it, then you haven't done your job. He needs to get the best care in, and most important, in the most heartfelt way. And there's no bigger message of what Torah is, of what chesed is, of what Torah shel chesed is. The Rebbe was Nifta, actually a few weeks after my father was Nifta, was 94. In his tzava, he left an incredible tzava, and he writes in it. He asks people to give him schusim, and he says, you know, Chazal say that for certain averis, people's children die. If I lost my wife and children, I'm far, far from being innocent. And yes, therefore, for people to schusim for him, his neshama, and so on, he said, I owe HaKadosh Baruch Hu so much, and I am so flawed, and so on. And that was his tzava. The story is an incredible story. It's a person who lived through b'chol nafshecha, v'after Hashem k'el b'chol nafshecha k'pshutoi, in a ways that we can't think are humanly possible. Just not possible. We're talking about keeping kosher. You're talking about people who haven't eaten, who for months. You're talking about any time you had water until Tulsi Daim came before drinking. You're talking about not walking walking 35 kilometers barefoot because it's Tisha B'Av. You're talking about hanhagas that are just not hanhagas of a person. And there was some, there was a quality about him that was extraterrestrial. He was sort of not shayach. I mean, he would speak in learning, he would speak in Torah, he would just go off and lose himself. He could speak for hours, b'kosha inyan to inyan. Things about him that were definitely of a different world. But for us, there's one important nekuda that we need to hold on to. We spoke about a hesped holding on to somebody. The Auschwitz is Admas Kodesh. We don't have words to talk about it. We don't have words to describe it. By Yidoy Maron, it's not a place we can talk about. There are people who cry out in tsar, and those are genuine cries of tsar, and a person is not nidoin, not nitfas, for shas, for tsar. No one could have gone through it and had the words to say, and that's another chelik of dibur. There are those who trample it with the regal gasa, that those who come well-fed, well-showered, dressed nicely for a speaking engagement, and present their side of the things, klapi kodesh b'richu. And there's a bas called Yoitzis, al tenideini regal gaiva, don't trample me with a haughty fat foot. The amokam ha'shalim of kodesh hu, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was there with a gilui neira. But one person whose coattails, whose thread of the coattails we can hang on to, that there was a bus of Adam that was there with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It was a bus of Adam. And a person who's davik in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, B'ktusha B'tara of Adivri Chaim's great-grandson, of Torah. He was a young boy. He once asked his father, he would say over many times when he remembered his father, he remembered, he was a precocious child. He asked his father once about the Nisayin, the Akedah, why was it so big if so many K'toshim and Tahirim did it? And he told him that because HaKadosh Baruch Hu told him, Espinchas Yechita Asher Hafta. And when HaKadosh Baruch Hu said Asher Hafta, it created an Ava Ein Seifis in Avram to Yitzchak. And he had to be oimed on that also. The Tzivui of Ahaleu had to match the Tzivui of Asher Hafta. He was a person that was kuli regish, kuli caught up in regish. And his suffering and sense of things was much sharper than ours, from the emotional side. And he felt that the schus was that he held on to Rebbein Shalom, and those are the words that he kept saying. He is with us. He came before us because he made this place for us. He held on in conditions that we don't understand, we'll never understand. And with his holy words of knowing, of saying that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was with him, we can also say those words. We can say his words. And it gives us a small achiza that in something that is beyond us, that we have no shaykhus to. S'chus ha'yogin aleinu, the Erez Alvonin. Erez Alvonin. Dear Tiger. Holy Jason, be Mishnah, be Gemara.